This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is sponsored by ChristianAudio.com. Listeners of the Gospel Coalition podcast can get Rosaria Butterfield's Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert audiobook download for free from Christian Audio. Add the audiobook to your cart at www.christianaudio.com and use the discount code TGC2016 at checkout. This offer is good through July 31, 2016. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. Today's podcast is a talk given by Jen Wilkin at our recent 2016 Women's Conference. It's called Raising an Alien Child.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jen Wilkin, and we are here today to talk about raising an alien child, helping our children trade the comfort of fitting in for the calling of standing out. And when I heard that the conference was going to be on 1 Peter, I got really excited because I do love to talk about parenting, and I love talking about parenting within the context of aliens and strangers language. I think it's really important for us to understand as parents what that means, not just for us as parents, but what it means for our children as well. So 1 Peter 2:11 through 12 says, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day He visits us." And so this is the call for all of us as Christian homes, as Christian families, is to live such good lives, such honorable lives among those who don't share our beliefs, that they might see from our example who we serve and give glory to the one that we serve. And that is a big deal. That's a big deal, and it's a heavy charge. So if you'll just allow me to open us in prayer, and then we will see where we can go with this. Heavenly Father, I thank you for each woman who is here, and I thank you for each family that is represented by the women that are here. Father, we need wisdom. We are daily aware of our lack when it comes to this thing called parenting. And so we ask you, Father, grant us wisdom to raise our children in the fear and admonition of you. Give us courage and give us strength. And we ask all these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So when I was in seventh grade, I was 5'8", which meant that I was quite a bit taller than most of the boys. I was incredibly awkward. I had braces, and this is back when braces meant you had a metal band on every single one of your teeth. I wanted to have someone else's hair, like I never wanted my own hair. And so I had wings. Do you ever have wings? And I would spray them with so much hairspray that if I was outside and the wind blew, the whole wing would just stand up or go back down. And I so wanted to fit in. I just did. I think all of us have some memory of a time, whether it was middle school or maybe high school, where I just knew I was gangly and weird, and I just wanted to fit in. And so I thought the solution to this would be for me to try out for cheerleader. Despite the fact that I had never had one day of gymnastics, was terribly uncoordinated, and did not know what I was doing. And so part of the cheerleading tryout process was that you had to have a white polo shirt and khaki shorts. And all of the other girls had a actual Ralph Lauren polo shirt with the little guy riding the horse and the mallet and the whole thing. But there were five children in my family, and in fact, my parents were divorced. It was two homes, so it wasn't like everybody was swapping around $100 bills all the time. We were all just, you know, trying to make it all work. And my stepmother was, in an act of kindness, said, "I just want to take you and get you the right things." Like, she wanted me. She was always so sweet about trying to find ways for me to have what the other kids had. And in fact, one time she sewed, and one time she, on Christmas morning, I opened a dress and I pulled it out, and it was this really cute dress, and the label said Neiman Marcus. She had cut, this made me cry, she had cut the Neiman Marcus label out of one of her old dresses she had found in a closet and sewn it into this dress she had made for me, because all of my friends were fancy and worn things from Neiman Marcus. It was really sweet. So she was really aware of all these things, and but on this one occasion, she kind of dropped the ball. She took me to she took me to JCPenney and bought me this riderless horse shirt. And to this day, I blame her for not making cheerleader, because I think that was what was the problem, is I did not have a man and a mallet on my shirt. In fact, when I went to do my cartwheel, I fell in front of the entire student body. And so I carry that shame around me to this day, wear it like a cloak. And I'm aware of how memories like this in our own lives have a dramatic impact on the way that we raise our children. And so often, the decisions that we are making as parents have less to do with what is good. I can talk loud enough without the mic. Have less to do with what is good and right for our child, and sometimes more to do with sort of medicating a past hurt that we carry around from our own childhood experience, or trying to recreate some past happy memory that we carry around from our childhood. And so I think as we start on this topic today, I want you to hear me say, it's going to be important to be thinking about what it is that has shaped you as a person, as a parent. You know, what past elements are playing into the decisions you're making as a parent today. And then on top of that, I need you to hear me say that I can tell you what I did in my family, but you can't lift what I did in my family and just impose it on your family. It's so important. Any parenting resource that you're using, you have to think critically about what you are reading, because every family is not the same. Every family is made up of a unique set of individuals with a unique set of personalities and strengths and weaknesses and challenges and gifts. And that means that any advice that you hear from anyone on parenting is something that you have to say, what can I take and what do I need to leave behind? So I'm going to tell you things that we did, and you're going to leave going, her home is perfect if I do it right. No, I'm kidding. Just know that you need to take what you can use and leave the rest behind. So one of the defining characteristics of our home has been that we had our children so close together in age. I think I mentioned this already. We had 4 children in 4 years. So my youngest is exactly 4 years and 2 weeks younger than my oldest. So Matt turned 4. And in fact, I had the first 3 in under 2.5 years. So I know, what in the world? I see photos from that time period, and my stomach just knots up, and I looked at my husband. We were looking at this one from Mother's Day, the year that Calvin was born, and I turned to my husband, and I was like, I am terrified. Who is going to take care of these babies? Like, just looking at the picture made me feel panicked. So we've always had a peer group in our home. My children have grown up as a peer group with one another. Not only that, but I had 2 boys and 2 girls, which made things like room sharing make a lot of easy sense for us. So I'm going to tell you some things. Please know they're coming from my experience, and you may be able to use parts of it. If you had your children 6 years apart, some of the things that worked in my home may not work in your home, but you may be able to find a principle in them. And so that's what I would hope. So what I have to ask you as we talk about this question of raising an alien child is, what is your greatest hope for your child? What is your greatest hope for your child? Now, if I were to ask this question at the PTA meeting, for example, I would get an array of answers if people were being honest. And it might be things like, I want my child to be successful, or I want my child to be happy, or I want my child to be a contributing member of society. Those are the kinds of things that might be said. And oftentimes, underlying those statements, there would be another idea that was something like this. Not in all cases, but in many cases. I want my child to make me look good. Or I want my child to do the things that I didn't get to do. So this whole idea of sort of self-actualizing through our children. But this is not the PTA meeting. And so if I were to ask this question of a group of Christian mothers, what is your greatest hope for your child? I hope your answer would sound different. Here is what my answer would be. My hope for my child, my greatest hope, is that they would grow to know, love, and serve God with everything they have. That they would grow to know, love, and serve God with everything that they have. Now, I know that I cannot raise Christian children. I can't. That's up to the Holy Spirit. I cannot raise a child so that a child will come to saving faith. And so that kind of places a conundrum before the Christian parent, because if I can't do that, if that's not my job, like I get that my job is to create the environment where that is most likely to happen, but what does that environment look like? I would say that as parents who want to raise children in this way, it is incumbent on us to raise them as part of a family that acknowledges Christ as Lord, whether the child does yet or not. And that means that we will hold our children to a standard of behavior that represents Christ's likeness, whether there has been an internal change already or not. Now, I know what you're thinking. Isn't that legalism? Isn't that going to devolve into a legalistic environment? No. Not if you maintain high relational value with your children, right? So when we talk about the priority of community in the church, which is a family, why do we value community in the church so much? Because it's what keeps us accountable. It's what keeps this a living organism and not just merely a place where we all ascribe to some creed. Well, the same thing is true in your family. Why do I want to obey the commands of God as a believer? Because I love God. And the commands enable me to have relationship with him. Now, don't mishear that. I did not just say, if you obey, you have relationship with God, right? I should get kicked out of the Gospel Coalition Conference for saying something like that. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying in the life of a believer, it is our joy to obey the commands of God because they illustrate the character of God. So, as a parent, I am faced with two options. I can raise a lawless child or a lawful child. It is worth noting that in Scripture, when those who are unsaved are referred to, they are often referred to as the sons of what? Lawlessness. So law is not the problem. I mean, it can be the problem. Law points out our sin, all those kinds of things. But think about this from a home management standpoint. Have you ever been in a lawless home environment? How healthy are the parent-to-child relationships in a lawless home environment? So having rules, any first-grade teacher can tell you this. Having rules, having standards is what enables us to function as a community. So if we want to have community within the home, it means that we will strive to raise lawful children. Now, not that they are trying to earn approval, all those things, but that they will learn. Here's the deal. It's learning to submit to authority. If my child does not submit to my authority, what hope do I have that they will one day submit to God's authority? And so there are ways to institute these good and right boundaries for our children and maintain a high relational credibility between me and my child so that we don't communicate, you earn my favor, you have to be good enough. We communicate it in terms of, because we are a family, it is good for us to have rules that help us all to flourish and love one another better. So that's how I'm going to speak about these things. If you are getting a strong legalistic vibe from me, you're mishearing me. That is not what I want to communicate to you. So, to grow, to know, love, and serve God with everything that they have. If we are to raise those children, if we in fact pulled that off, if we raised a child who grows to know, love, and serve God with everything that they have, we will raise children who don't stand a snowball's chance in hell of blending in. So then the question becomes, how much of our decision-making with regard to our children centers around helping them fit in? It's a very strong pull for us. We talk a lot about how susceptible children are to peer pressure, but it's so important for us as parents to recognize our own susceptibility to parental peer pressure and how the comparison game is shaping the way that we make choices for our children who are not yet old enough to make them for themselves. And so those are some of the things that I would like us to think about. How much of our decision-making with regard to our children centers around helping them fit in? What opportunities are we taking to train them, this is important, to feel comfortable with being different? Now, does being different, does standing out mean that they have to be social rejects? Does it mean we're going to outlaw zippers and I'll be Amish? No offense to the Amish. You are lovely people. What does it mean to be an alien and a stranger? What does it mean? What does it mean for a child to be raised in a family that is alien and strange? So I think Romans 16, 19 can help us here. It says, "But I want you to be wise as to what is good and innocent as to what is evil." So it doesn't mean that we withdraw from culture. It means that we have wisdom around these issues of good and evil, and we teach those to our children. Matthew 10, 16 says, "Behold, I am sending you out," okay, so going out into their midst, "sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves." So it is not that we are going to raise children who are going to be isolated from the world, but we are going to raise children who, as far as they are in the world, are very aware that they are not of the world, and they're comfortable with that. So have you thought about how, when I was a kid at least, I didn't feel like there were this many activities. Do you feel like there were as many options for you? Right. So I think it's important for us to acknowledge that one of the major things that is driving the number of options that there are for your child to participate in is affluence. We have more money than our parents had, and don't you think that everybody out there who is running a gym or a dance studio or whatever would be happy to take some of that money from you? And how can they do it? They can play on your sense of either your own unfulfilled desires or your sense of comparison to someone else. And it is a multi-million dollar business. So one of the funniest things that I laugh about is how people would say to me when they, "Oh, you have daughters? Yeah. Hey, I know how you can get them a college scholarship. There's tons of golf scholarships for girls." And I was like, "I think you can't do math." Because by the time I get my daughter a college golf scholarship, I will have sold my soul in greens fees and outfits and clubs and private lessons. I'm pretty sure that's a losing financial proposition. So how do we decide what is worth our time, what is not worth our time? How do we decide, and why should we decide? Well, here's a big why for you. Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 9 says this, "And these words that I command to you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit down in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." Did you catch that? The writer of Deuteronomy seems to think that there will actually be times when we are in our houses together. Seems to think that there will be times when we walk by the way together, and when we lie down together, and when we rise together. The author of Deuteronomy seems to think that we will have a natural rhythm of the home that brings us together. So when we look at activities, we have to be very careful to evaluate their cost-benefit relationship to the time that we have as a family. If a child is overcommitted, it is not because the child signed up for all of those things, is it? We are the gatekeepers of our children's calendars. I've told this several times. Maybe you've heard me talk about this. When my children started high school, that the guidance counselor told us, "Hey, you want to know the number one thing I see kids in the counseling office for?" And we all, I promise you, every parent in that gym thought that she would say drugs or alcohol or something like that. And she said, "Anxiety and depression related to sleep deprivation and overscheduling." So we need to think carefully about what we're committing our children to, because if our children are overscheduled, it's really on us until they're out of our homes. Another thing we need to keep in mind is that thing, that elusive unicorn quality time that we all want with our children, quality time is a function of quantity time. You cannot schedule quality time. Quality time is a subset of big blocks of time that we spend together. And when it shows up, it is wonderful. But you can't predict it and you cannot schedule it. So you have to make room for it. Quality time is a function of quantity time. So which activities are worthwhile? Which activities are worth us giving our investment to? Here are some questions that you can consider. First of all, full disclosure, because my kids were so close together in age, can you imagine what my life would have been like if everybody had been involved in three things? So I want to say up front, The decisions we had to make are probably more conservative than some of you will have to make. I am not prescribing this to you, but because of the ages and closeness of our kids and our finances, we had a rule with the kids that they could do one or none. One or none. That was a mind-bending concept to some of the parents that I knew who, when they hear that your kid does none, and we had a child who chose none every time. He's turned out great. He taught himself the guitar. I mean, he's a huge reader. He did all these things. But the idea of none, like children have a social identity around their activities these days. And so if I meet your child, I'll get down on their level and go, "Hi, little Jimmy, what do you do?" "Hey, little Jimmy don't got a job." Right? But Jimmy be like, "I play baseball." "How many practices do you have?" "We have 14 practices a week and 3 games on Saturday." "Oh, and I also do gymnastics." Our children, we more and more are having a social identity around these activities that we have placed them in. But I want to just say to you, if you have secretly been wishing that your child could do zero activities, it's really okay. You could do that. So some of our children would only do one thing for a little while. Sometimes they would do no things for a season. They would lobby to have more than one activity. I made an exception for music lessons. I would allow you to take music lessons and have some sort of athletic thing. And I'll talk a little bit more about why that was the case. So which activities are worthwhile? The first question you can ask is, does it sabotage life skill training? What do I mean by that? If your schedule is so compacted with outside things that your child is not learning to take responsibility for things like folding laundry or keeping their room clean, if you're to the point where you're like, "You know what, I'm just going to do it because we're not even going to be around," I would say it's probably time to reevaluate what's going on. Because when your child is 25 and living on his own, he will probably not need to make a free throw to have a successful life, but he will need to know how to fold the laundry, you know, take care of his own personal responsibilities from a life skill training perspective. So if your schedule is reaching a point where you are not able to make time to be training your child how to take on reasonable responsibilities in the home and learn how to do them well, that would be a reason to reevaluate. Second, does an activity sabotage weekend downtime or worship? So maybe it's not weekend downtime. Maybe you find downtime at another point in the week because you have a commitment for a while that is taking up that space. Maybe you're involved in something that occasionally has a game during a time when you're at church. I don't think you have to say, "Well, that's from the devil. We're never doing that." But I do think you have to keep an eye on it, right? I mean, you can decide for yourself whether your conscience allows you to miss worship for a game occasionally or whether that's something you never want to do. That's not on me to decide for you. But I think there's room for discussion around that, because I think when we get into these discussions, you want to say, "Well, this is the right way and that's the wrong way." But I would be more concerned with asking myself the question, what characterizes the way that I think about these things? Look for patterns. So does it sabotage weekend downtime or worship? If it is going to torpedo every single weekend from now until Jesus returns, I'm probably not going to get involved in it. If it's seasonal or if it's something I can keep a rein on, I'm more likely to commit my child to it. Next, does it sabotage family dinners? This is a big one, right? It doesn't seem like a big one, but we are at a point where if you have family dinner 3 or 4 times a week, you're the most countercultural person on your block. And I can tell you from firsthand experience that that is probably my number one thing that helped us keep that strong relational tie that you're going to need so that it doesn't devolve into rules and regulations. That was a place where we knew we were going to sit down and eyeball each other and hear what was going on in each other's lives and have the conversations where quality time would surprise us right in the middle of the salad. Those are the kinds of places that happened. And so if you occasionally miss a dinner for a sport, that's one thing. But if it means, and I'm using sport as a general term, it can be any activity, then I would say keep an eye on that. And it doesn't mean you quit right that minute. It means you keep an eye on it. Start looking at how much time you're giving to it. How many dinners have we missed? Because there's a financial implication too as well, right? I mean, you're going to be eating in your car all the time, really awesome food that you can get through a fast food lane. So there are nutritional issues, but there's a much bigger spiritual issue associated with it. And studies show that children who have family dinner at least three times a week are far less likely to take drugs, to get involved with alcohol. They're just more grounded. They have more of a sense of family identity. Next, does the activity sabotage bedtime? Particularly for you moms of younger children, I would just ask you to Google on the interwebs where everything is true. How much sleep does a child of whatever age your child is need? It will be higher than what you think. It will blow you away. And so it's really weird because once my kids got into high school, they turned into newborns again. They slept all the time. They ate all the time. And they made enormous quantities of laundry. So children go through these, they go through these periods of time, but consistently, my children have always... If your children are acting out, the first question you should ask yourself is, are they getting enough rest? But it's so often a question we don't get to. We're like, why is that kid so rotten? And they were rotten yesterday and they're rotten today. And we forget that they have been, slowly losing sleep time. And so I would say pay attention to that. And an activity that sabotages bedtime. And here's the thing. Sabotaging bedtime. So say your 13-year-old is involved in an activity that requires you to take your 4-year-old to the practice. And so your 4-year-old doesn't get to go to bed because you're there with the 13-year-old. That's another thing you need to factor in to whether it's something worth sticking with. Next, does the activity pull our family apart or push us together? So there are ways of thinking about these activities that mean that we're all off in our own place doing our own thing. Dad golfs, mom sells essential oils, Susie does gymnastics, and Bobby plays baseball. But when are mom and dad, Susie and Bobby, all doing things that are shared things that they do? So your whole family should take square dancing because that's something you can all do together. No, not at all. I mean, go ahead. But think about this in terms of, okay, if Bobby's playing baseball, that's great. Here's what we did in our family. As much as was possible, when Bobby has a game, we're all going to go be there. And I realize what I'm saying. I know how hard it is because that's what we did. And sometimes I'd say, yeah, bring your homework along. I get it. But let's go and let's watch Matt play, or let's go, do this together. And that way you're maintaining some sense of family time. And it's a shared activity, even if it's not just there, even if it's only that child's one thing to do. You're looking for ways for us to be in the same place, not for ways to us to be in different places, although there are certainly appropriate times for us to be in different places as well. Does it pull our family apart or push us together? So like travel teams, that's a pretty good example of where you end up having to divide and conquer a lot. It doesn't mean you don't do it. It means you keep an eye on it, right? To make sure that you're not constantly, oh, two of you are at home and two of you are off somewhere or whatever. You're looking for ways that you can all be in the same place. Next, is it an activity my child can enjoy or benefit from into adulthood? Okay, so this explains why we allowed music lessons to be a cheater way of having two activities at once. So my son Matt plays the piano. He played football. My kids didn't. I mean, they were involved in things as we were able to do that. My daughters played women's lacrosse all the way through high school. My son played football through his sophomore year. He played basketball. Claire played volleyball. So they were doing things. When it came to a limited number of choices that we could fit into our family calendar, we were always going to give priority to the thing that would take them into adulthood versus the thing that could only be enjoyed during high school. So this was something that I got actually from my husband. He was good enough to play college football. He didn't. But midway through high school, he chose between football and basketball. And he has regretted it ever since because he's like, I can play a game of pickup basketball anytime I want, but you can't gather a bunch of guys to play tackle football. Plus, I'm too old, he would say now. So just thinking in terms of, okay, is this something that they can enjoy for the rest of their lives? I'm going to give priority to that first. Here's an important one. Can we afford it? Can we afford it? It is not accurate to say we should spare no expense to expose our children to every option. If you have a child who is Olympic quality, you will not need someone to give them private lessons to find that out. So just that child is going to find their way to that. You are not robbing your child of an NFL career if you don't give them multiple chances to become the most awesome kid on the flag football team. You should not be going into debt over your children's activities. Let's say it that way. Then also, is the activity appropriate to my child's age? So the higher the commitment level, the less appropriate it is for a young child. Just keep that in mind as you're thinking about how that'll all play out. Notice that in this list of questions, I did not have the question, does my child love it? It is not that it doesn't matter whether your child loves it, but can we be honest here? Your child loves Skittles and Pop-Tarts and would eat them for dinner every night. You are the parent. You set the decisions for these things. It's the older a child is, the more you can factor in a question like that. It becomes more of a valid thing to consider. But a lot of times I'll hear parents say, oh, but he just loves it, and I can see it in their face. You love it. You love what this does. And maybe he does love it, but when it's totally torpedoing your ability to be a family, there's something else going on there. So again, keep in mind with all of these questions that any activity that your family takes on has a shared cost for the family as a whole. You can't just say, how does this impact little Jimmy's schedule? Because little Jimmy's schedule impacts everybody else's schedule as well. So as you're trying to determine where is it best for us to invest in activities as a family whose goal is different from the goals of other families who don't love the Lord, bear in mind that there is a shared cost for any activity. Okay? All right. Spent a lot of time on the first point, so let's move on. Second is the area of speech. An alien child does not sound like other children. This means that our homes need to be places where children learn to use kind words, where we disarm sarcasm and teasing. I hate talking about this because, as you can tell, I have a fully orbed sense of humor. And I grew up in a home where there was a great deal of sarcasm and teasing, and my husband did not. He was not allowed to tease his sister. And when I first heard this, I thought, what did you talk about at dinner? But over time, I learned that this was a much better way, because here's the thing. If you want your home to be your child's primary place of belonging, and don't hear that the wrong way. I'm not saying if you want your child to live with you until they're 50. I'm saying if you want your home to be a place that they enjoy coming back to always, and when they're in high school, you want your home to be the place of primary belonging, not their sports team or not their church group or any of those things, then it means that you need to have a shared language in that community, and it needs to be a shared language that invites dialogue and safety. And neither sarcasm nor teasing invite those things, and so we have to be very careful with them. So, as a parent, I would urge you to model and to instruct that there not be sarcasm. And sarcasm is a form of verbal domination, okay? And particularly with small children who don't have well-developed verbal skills, it's verbal bullying. And so as a parent, we have to be so careful that we are watching the way that we're speaking to our kids, because here is a tried and true maxim. If you do not want your children to yell at you when they turn 13, what do you think is the best way to prevent that from happening? Don't yell at them. That's right. We hear the tone that we have given to our children when they were small come right back at us when they hit adolescence. So just keep that in your back pocket while your kids are little. And as much as you may want to decisively win by scoring a verbal hit, try to refrain. Try to refrain and try to choose words that are life-giving and that allow, because here's the thing. So like parents always are concerned about, hey, how do I have the big conversations, right? Like how do I talk about sex or how do I talk about faith? And they always want to know, like, what did we do? We did not have a big conversation about faith. We did not have a big conversation about sex. We had 1,000 small ones because we tried to develop a culture of conversation within our home, so that the kids knew if they came to us and asked a question, they would get a straight answer and we would be willing to talk about it as long as they wanted. Now, keep in mind that that is not lecturing, right? You understand these rhetorical terms. Dialogue, monologue, soliloquy. You know what those are? So dialogue is you and I are having a conversation. Monologue is I'm talking to you and you're listening. What's soliloquy? I'm talking and no one is listening. And that is so often what parent-child conversations can devolve into. So keep at the forefront of your mind, I want a home where there is that first thing, dialogue, where we are having, and now with a small child, that is different. As a child gets old enough to enter into dialogue, you go from telling to asking, right? You're trying to draw them in and get them to own the conversation. So, for example, when he whacks his brother and he's old enough to know better, you don't say, Jimmy, don't whack your brother. Because what is that? It's either monologue or soliloquy. So how do you turn it into dialogue? Jimmy, what should you do? Then old Jimmy has to own what he just did, right? And as soon as he articulates for you what he should have done, well, he'll be a dummy if he does it again. So it just changes the way that happens, and he now owns responsibility for his behavior instead of just trying to avoid you saying something negative to him again. So dialogue is always our goal, and in order to have dialogue, you have to have a safe place, and that means that you want speech that is seasoned with salt, as the scriptures say. And I like to think about this in terms of the fruit of the Spirit. You know, those love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. So you want loving speech. You want joyful speech. You want peaceful speech. You want patient speech, kind speech, gentle speech, speech that is self-controlled. These are the kinds of words that we want to characterize our homes. And that's how we can raise children who are incredibly alien and strange. So we knew that when the kids hit middle school, it was going to turn ugly because everybody starts to experiment with the power of words at new levels. So sarcasm and then, of course, swearing, right? So well, that starts earlier, but we sent our children into middle school armed with this. If someone is being bullying to you or is speaking to you in an ugly way, say to them, that's not kind. Thanks, Mom. That's a big help. So sometimes some of the kids were too ashamed to even say that's not kind, but they would not respond in kind, and that's still a win, okay? But you're trying to train your children. You respond to antagonistic speech by calling it what it is without making it personal. Like, you don't say you're not kind. That's not kind. And then walk away. You don't have to defend yourself. You don't have to have the quick comeback. Walk away. Hold your head high. It's a hard thing for children to learn. They won't get it right 100% of the time. And they need to see it modeled by you in your home, that if someone comes against you, you know, like say your husband snaps at you, that you don't respond to him by snapping back, but you say, hey, that hurt my feelings. And then you have a conversation that's resolved, those kinds of things. So make your home a place where there are kind words, words that exhibit the fruit of the Spirit. And then I would say diffuse swear words. Right? Because children are looking for what is forbidden and why is it forbidden and what secrets should I keep and what secrets should I tell. Get way out ahead of it. Hey, you know what? This is what we did with Matt. I know all the swear words. Test me. And he would come home and say, do you know this one? Do you know this one? Yeah, I know that one. And then we'd talk about what it meant. And then we would say them out loud together and talk about how they sound funny or they're, you know, people, how many different ways can people use that one word? Well, they use it like this, they use it like that. And we would talk about that. And then we'd talk about why do you never hear Dad and me use those words? Right? Because again, those are, and what's implied behind those words? Like if you call someone that, what are you saying? You're making them less than, and you know, just kind of talk about all those things. But then the word is something that doesn't have power anymore. And also when you establish credibility around something like that you actually did know, because kids think parents don't know. They think what is talked about at the lunch table is like this mystery of the universe that's only been revealed to them. And you need them to know, I know about it, it doesn't scare me, and you can talk to me about it. Because some scary things are going to come to the lunch table. And you want them to come home and tell you. So make your home a place where speech is safe and inviting, and teach them to be children who exercise speech that's safe. Next, an alien child will probably not dress like other children. I can't tell you how your child should dress. I'm not saying that you need to come up with some outfit that just makes them stand out and look like a freak. Please don't do that to your child. But because we are Christian homes, we spend our money in different ways than homes that are not, and that will involve the way that we dress. So when you're talking about clothing, it's good to have discussions with your children about wants versus needs. If I had said to my stepmom, I really want the Ralph Lauren shirt, my stepmom would have said to me, in all honesty, we do not have the money for the Ralph Lauren shirt. But you babysit, so I have money for the $20 version, and if you want to pay the difference, then You can have it, right? So then I get the Ralph Lauren shirt. I spill ketchup on it the second time I wear it. And I'm like, why did I spend my money on this shirt that was no better than the shirt that was less expensive? So we don't have to monitor every choice that the children make with their money. They're allowed to learn success and failure with money. In fact, we want them to. We want them to learn success and failure while they're in our home. And it's safe to fail. And the consequences for it are still relatively low. So children who are never given room to fail go off to college and they fail colossally and they have no framework for it. And then the wheels come off. So you want them to know how to recover from failure while they're still in your home. So one of the ways that you can give your child opportunities to learn that is to let them make some decisions around how they want to spend money regarding their clothing. But you have to discuss needs versus wants. Why? Because in our culture, we say, oh, I really need this or I really need that. And it's hard for me, too, because I walk into Target and I'm like, I really need pretty much everything between here and the register. And I had to learn to coach myself not to use the term need, right? Because it's not accurate. And of course, now my kids are old enough to where everybody gets it. But when they're small, it really does matter that you make sure you're saying things in a way that they can hear and learn a principle from. So it's important to discuss needs versus wants. Now, this is a tricky one. It's important to discuss modesty. I hate where the modesty conversation has gone. I hate it. It's been really hard to talk to my daughters about this in a way that doesn't make them feel liable for the sin patterns of others. So the way I've tried to frame it up with my girls is, it is not your responsibility to keep another man pure, but as a human being, don't you want someone to look at your eyes when they're talking to you? That's what I want. And so my hope is that we would dress in a way where we are looked in the eye, because that's what everyone deserves. And so we tried to look at it in that way. Now, another thing, in my case, the public schools have been my friend because they had a fairly rigorous dress code. And so if someone came home in something where you're like, or wanted to buy something where you're like, I could just say, honey, you can't wear that to school. So from a financial standpoint, it doesn't make sense for us to buy it. And so look for ways to align what you really want to happen with a higher authority, right? Because here's the deal. We're going to have to say no a lot as parents. And so what we want to be able to commit to our children is, I will say no to you as little as possible. I will only say no when I really mean it, when it really matters. And so insofar as you can take something and not make it you saying no, but make it a logical, good reason for not doing it, avail yourself of that. So around the modesty discussion, I would say it is one that you need to have with your daughters and with your sons, but frame it in a way that is not shaming. Frame it in a way that is about them honoring their own personhood in whatever room that they are in. And it will be important to talk to daughters about safety around this. My good friend Wendy talks about it this way. She says, I have a friend who was robbed. She left her house unlocked. She should live in a world where she doesn't have to lock her house, but she doesn't. So I would say to her, next time, lock your house. So I would say, think about the way that we dress in those terms with our daughters. It's good to think through, not because I'm trying to protect someone else, but because I respect that the Lord has given me this body and it's my job to do things with it that honor him. Okay, next, discuss competitive dress. It's important for our kids to understand that so often the clothes that we choose are a way of establishing ascendancy over someone else, and that is an anti-Christian ethic. So, it's okay to want to look nice. It's okay to want to look pretty. It's not okay to want to win. So that can be a good conversation to have with your children around clothing. Fourth, possessions. And this ties in with what we just talked about. Your child, an alien child, will not own what other children own. More specifically, they will not own what other children own when they own it. This is such an important concept for us to understand. We want our children to delay having sex until marriage, right? So we're in big trouble if in every other area of our lives we do not inculcate delayed gratification. You cannot say, wait for sex until marriage, but don't wait for anything else. As soon as you want it, we will go get it. So, because what do we want? We don't want children who obey external controls. We want children who have an internal mechanism for control. And so, look for ways to teach delayed gratification to your child. What can we say yes to? What do we need to say no to? And what needs to be a not now? And what is going on in the homes of their peers is not going to be your measuring rod. It's going to be what works for your family. So for our family, what worked was we didn't give, and this is outdated, so I'm not prescribing this. I'm reporting on what happened in my home when my kids were in middle school. We waited until eighth grade to give them a phone. When we gave them a phone, it was a Go phone that they had to pay for. So it didn't have data. They couldn't do anything with it, really, except needful communication, which, P.S., that's what a phone is for. So that was what we wanted. We wanted, before you learn the other things a phone can be for, learn what a phone is actually for. And they would say, but Mom, what if I'm somewhere and I need to call you? And I'm like, all your friends got phones. Just reach over and borrow one. You know, it's not like you can't communicate with me if you need to. So, and here's another thing, thinking about with the phones. This is just one example of a possession that you might want to think about carefully. I know a lot of times a parent will give a child a phone so that they can feel a level of comfort about when the child is not with them. I would urge you to consider that you're more likely to take a risk on where you will allow your child to go because they have the phone. And that's not a great way to operate. So don't let the phone give you a false sense of comfort about letting them go somewhere with a group of kids you think is kind of shady, because they can call you if anything goes wrong. Try to picture that thing playing out without the phone as a factor and ask yourself, how comfortable would I be? And then make your decision based on that. So you can talk to your children about things like the difference between wanting a new thing and using what you had from last year. Look for examples that you can point them to. Did you notice how you didn't die when we didn't buy you that new thing you needed? Wasn't that awesome? Talk to your children about more versus less and more versus enough, right? Our children are losing the concept of enough, and we think that if we keep giving them the next thing that they will find satisfaction, but what we're actually doing is training them in insatiability. So it's really important for our children to learn the concept of enough as those who call Christ the Lord of our homes. You can look for touch points for them. Make sure that they are around people who do not have enough. Make sure they have ways to maybe support a compassion child, something like that. Find ways. If you don't live around people who don't have enough, take your children and get them around people who don't have enough so that it will impact the way they think about possessions. Next, entertainment. An alien child will not watch, read, or listen to the same things that their peers do. I want to qualify this. I cannot tell you what I think your child can and can't watch. That's between you and the Lord. You employ the God-given wisdom that He gives you in a sober-minded way. I'm not going to tell you, don't watch this channel, do watch this channel, don't give your kid an iPad, any of those things. You navigate that on your own, but here are some guiding principles to think about. Obviously, screen time is a big issue just in general from a developmental standpoint. The American Academy of Pediatricians recommends zero screen time for children under the age of 2. Zero. I praise God that the iPhone did not exist when I had children under the age of 2. You girls are up against a tough battle. You really are. So, but developmentally speaking, it just seems to be a potentially devastating thing. And so I would say keep an eye on it. Be aware of your own tendency to use entertainment to get you off the hook with a parenting issue, or like, so maybe I don't have to exercise patience because I can put some sort of entertainment in front of my child. Be aware of the tendency of our culture to use entertainment as a medication and use it for what it should be. It should be a time of just lightheartedness. It should be a time where we're able to sort of just exhale a little bit. But here's another principle that it's really important for the Christian home to maintain, because remember I said it's really important for us to be a place where we have community. So how can our entertainment be a shared experience instead of an individual experience? So one of the ways that we saw this play out in our family is when we would take long car trips, it can be really tempting to have everybody on their own device listening to their own music or watching their own show, and then everybody's happy, right? Everybody may be happy, but you know what everybody's not doing? They're not talking to each other. They're not sharing a moment. None of that is happening. And so it's not that those times never happen, But I would say long car trips provided a perfect time for my family, where we had a peer group, to have a shared entertainment experience around whatever crazy parameters I placed on it. So, you know, I'd say you can have one show. We have an 11-hour drive out to my parents. You can have one show in the morning, one show in the afternoon. So you know what they would do? They'd choose The Sound of Music every time because it's 3.5 hours long. But the idea was, and then when we were listening to music as much as possible, we would have music on in the car that we all listened to, which means that my poor son, Matt, he goes off to college and he says to me, "Mom, nobody's ever heard of Casey and the Sunshine Band." I was like, "Well, that's terrible. You need to help out your friends." So he likes all this like classic 80s rock because that's what he had to grow up listening to in the car and stuff like that. But so we now have sort of like this, you know, and so now it's, oh, hey, everybody watch this, or hey, everybody come sit down. It's like if they find a video on YouTube that they think is awesome, they want us to all come sit and watch it. And I'm kind of to the point where I'm like, I don't need to watch it. Can we stop the communal entertainment thing now? But think about ways that your entertainment options can bring you together instead of pulling you apart. Next, friends. An alien child, will not invest in the same kinds of relationships that other children do. It is incumbent on Christian parents to train our children to recognize character. We need to train our children to recognize and flee from drama and disorder. Now, this means that we cannot have drama and disorder modeled in our homes, or they will not know to flee from it. So with my daughters in particular, and I don't mean to place this unfairly on the fairer sex, but there does tend to be a bit of drama among girls groups. And my daughter would come home and describe to me a manipulative behavior, but she can't put her finger on what the problem is. All she knows is she doesn't like it, right? Well, I can help talk her through that. How did that make you feel? What do you think she needs from this? Well, how does that make you feel if that's the way your friendship, you know, do you want to keep investing as much time into a friendship where this, you know, has this happened before? So you help them establish patterns. One of the ways that we were able to help them recognize these bad relational patterns outside of our home was by saying inside of our home, no one has permission to press the drama button. Not me, not dad, no one. And that way, when they're at school and someone presses the drama button, it's alarming and foreign. And they're able to say, I think that's what my parents are talking about when they're talking about what's a healthy relationship. And so you can coach them through some of those things, train them to flee from drama and disorder. I don't mean you abandon those friendships. I mean, my kids have had some friendships that have persevered through their middle school and high school years that have cycled through drama. And can we be honest? Isn't that what it's like as an adult as well? I would love to say that drama goes away when we all grow out of it, but we don't all seem to grow out of it. So it's an important skill to know, how do I handle a relationship that is characterized by those kinds of things? And so we train that to our children. We also work to make home their primary place of belonging. I mentioned this a little earlier. Again, I don't mean that they never leave home or that they're creepy and just sort of lurk in the living room all the time. I mean that home is where their deepest relationships exist. So the play date is a big deal, right? Now, again, my children were very close in age. When my children were fighting with each other, I was not looking for other people for them to go play with, because that's a sign to me that you are not doing what needs to happen within our home. So until we can get these primary relationships where they need to be, I'm not going to farm you out to somebody else. And so we told our children, and this, I got this from my husband. I didn't think it would work. Your sibling is your best friend. Your sibling is your best friend. And we just said it over and over again. Your sibling is your best friend. And the thing is his sibling was his best friend, and so he knew it was possible. I don't think I even had faith to believe it was possible. It is. It is our reality. I love it. It is the Lord's grace on our family. I wish I could have told you I knew it would work. I'm not saying universally it will work in every family. I'm saying it is absolutely worth fighting for. My husband was so good at saying to the kids, you know that kid that sits next to you in your second grade class? You're never going to see him again. It's a real comforting thought, right? But one day, you and your siblings are going to care for your mom and me as we age. You will always have your brothers and sisters. They are your best friends. So that goes back to the shared time thing, right? We got to find ways to make sure that they are together and not alone together, not doing their own thing in the same place, but actually together. And one of the simplest ways that this worked for us was to have them share rooms. I know that doesn't work in every situation, and it is certainly not a prescription that I would make for everyone. But I will say in our case, having them have a roommate was so great. It meant that at night, even though I'm like the freaky rules girl who's like, it is lights out and everybody stop talking. But I would hear them up there laughing and giggling, right? And I so wanted to go up there and just shut that down. And then, you know, and Jeff is like, just sit down. This is so awesome. And he was absolutely right. And so then people would say, well, you have enough rooms in your house for them to not have roommates. And we were like, but yeah, but here's the thing. So like Matt, he shared a room with his brother Calvin from the time that Calvin moved out of his nursery, which was actually our bathroom and our master bedroom, up into his room. So he shared a room with Calvin in a crib, all the way to Calvin and Matt in bunk beds. Matt's 6'5" on the bottom bunk with his feet dangling off to one side until he went off to college. You know why? Because when he went off to college, guess what? He slept in a bunk bed and had a roommate. And then he's going to get married. And I hope they won't have bunk beds. But he's going to have a roommate. And so they had to work through conflict, right? They had to find ways. And so now Mary-Kate has been off at college. Mary-Kate and Claire are 15 months apart. Mary-Kate's been off at college. Claire comes home. Mary comes home. And the whole week before she gets here, Claire is like, I cannot wait for her to get back. I cannot wait for her to get back. Mary-Kate says, I can't wait for Claire to get down to college. She's so fun. I can't wait for everybody to meet her. Because they, and then they're up there giggling again at night. I didn't know it was possible. So I'm here to give you a word of hope. It is possible, and it's such a joyful thing to see, but it will require that you think hard about how to make it happen. So what is the bottom line here? All of our decisions as parents must be evaluated against this question, will this thing help my child know, love, and serve God with everything they have? Will it help that, or will it detract from that? And of course, the only reliable way to raise an alien child is to be an alien parent. And so that is my prayer for each of you, that as mom, you yourself will strive to know, love, and serve God with everything that you have. I know that right now it feels like the most important thing you can do is have right relationship with your child. But the most important thing that you can do is have right relationship with your Heavenly Father. That is what gives you your greatest hope for right relationship with your child. So, I am for you. I pray that this is a room full of women who will raise children who are countercultural in their kindness and in their ability to delay gratification and in their well-rested, delightful demeanors. I am praying that we will, without ever saying a word, though we will certainly have to say a word, be families whose lives shout the gospel. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for these women. Thank you for the precious children represented here. Father, give us courage. Give us boldness. Give us steadfastness. Give us the right motives, Lord. Help us to raise children for your glory and not our own. Help us to know that it is a privilege to live as an alien and a stranger and to raise children who do the same. And we ask all these things in your Son's name. Amen.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.